Lord Percy was Minister of Education from 1924 to 1929, descended from the Percy that pops up in Shakespeare from time to time. But despite his illustrious ancestry, he had no discernible effect on the education of the children of this country. He was very lazy. But he did invent a phrase which is still current. It's the phrase, happy clappy. Now, Lord Percy abhorred the tendency in schools at that time to try and make children happy. He thought that was a thoroughly bad idea. Quite so. He thought that life is unhappy and children should learn that as soon as possible. And he characterised the sort of education of trying to make people, children happy as happy-clappy. So that's where the phrase comes. Of course, he was spitting into the wind. The emphasis on children being happy has increased apace in the succeeding 90 years. But I think there's a bit of a sort of pushback as people think there should be some discipline in schools so children might conceivably learn something in their education. But nonetheless, happiness is the thing. And indeed, the happiness bug has spread. If you go into a prêt-à-manger restaurant, you might be surprised at how cheerful everybody is. Exuberant, jolly, eager to serve. And that's because they go on happiness training courses. And there are mystery consumers who turn up and find out that the Stamford prêt-à-manger, whatever it is, they're all behaving themselves and being suitably happy. It can put rather a strain on the employees, and very often, after a whole shift of being happy, they collapse into tears. But nonetheless, while it lasts, it's fine. And believe it or not, Ryanair sends their cabin crew on happiness courses. I know, it's hard to credit. As someone who flies on Ryanair, though, about three times a year, I must say I'm impressed that under the circumstances, they do remain remarkably cheerful. I certainly wouldn't. And then now, happiness is becoming the new management fad, replacing mindfulness. You probably missed the whole mindfulness thing, but now it's happiness. And there's a chap called Sean Anker, American, needless to say, who talks about happiness hygiene. So just as you have dental hygiene, you sort of brush your teeth every morning, so you should go through a happiness hygiene routine in the morning to make yourself really happy and ready to go out and meet the world. I've never found out what the routine is, so I remain miserable. And then there's another organisation that sells its services to managers called Smile Epidemic. And the idea here is that if you smile, it's not only a sign of being happy, it makes you happy. Please don't try it now, because having all of you beaming back at me, I think would put me off my stride. So happiness is all the rage. But when it comes to the phrase happy-clappy, as I'm sure you know, that's nowadays used almost exclusively to apply to worship. So charismatic, exuberant, emotional worship is termed happy-clappy. And it's always used as a phrase in a derogatory way. That somehow, if you go to choral evensong at the cathedral, that's altogether superior morally, spiritually, culturally, and everything else to that happy-clappy lot down the road. Of course, being happy-clappy isn't quite British. And that's the other point, that's sort of lurking there. Now, of course, all that's rubbish. What matters in worship is who you worship, not how you worship. But nonetheless, there is that snobbery attached to that phrase. But it does raise a key question for our mission and our purpose. Is our purpose to make people happy? Is that the gospel? Are we a happiness gospel, trying to make more and more people happy? Or is there something else? Is that kind of missing the point? Now, I'm going to tell you three little stories from my own rather odd pastoral experience that kind of illustrate and elucidate that question. One is about a person called June. All these are from a long time ago, actually, so I'm not in danger of breaching any confidences. The first is about a lady called June. She was a professional woman, obviously quite successful at whatever she did, I can't remember what it was, and she had oodles of dosh. She was well off. But her private life was a mess. It consisted of endless affairs that ended unhappily. And so she was an unhappy person. But then, through a friend, she started worshipping at Holy Trinity Brompton, which is the ultimate happy-clappy place of worship. And it suited her. And she loved it, and she had what she felt was a real conversion experience, giving her life to Christ. But then, several months later, she went on a camping holiday in Morocco. I think it was not quite camping as you and I might think. It was moving from one well-appointed set of Arab tents to another. But nonetheless, it was sort of camping. And some days into this, she was a victim of a sexual assault by one of the guides. And naturally, that greatly traumatized her. But it did more than that. See, her understanding of the deal, as it were, with Christ is if I, June, am obedient, say my prayers and are good, then you, God, will make me happy. So how was it that this terrible thing had happened within a few months of her conversion? What terrible thing could she have done to deserve that punishment? How had she broken, as it were, the deal with God? So she was racked with guilt, but she couldn't think what it was she had done wrong. She felt guilty about something, but she didn't know what. And in the end, the guilt was so heavy on her, and the only way she could escape it was to give up her faith altogether and assume that God didn't exist. So for her, Christianity did not genuinely lead to happiness. It actually led to misery. But then she had to abandon the faith. I don't know what's become of her. I'd like to know, but I don't. That's one story. The second story is similar, but wholly different. When I first became the minister at Upton near Huntingdon, there was a couple there, Clifford and Hilda, very prosperous. They lived in a sort of 4 or 5 bedroom house, double garage, posh cars, all that kind of stuff. And he, Clifford, had inherited from his father and grandfather a flourishing umbrella-making business. And he had built it up very well, and it was a large factory employing lots of people making umbrellas. And he was prospering, and hence the big house and so on. But then, and I think this was around the late 1980s, the market for umbrellas began to be flooded by cheap Chinese imports. And they were good quality, just as good as his umbrellas, but half the price, because they were obviously being made by much cheaper labour. And he couldn't compete. If he reduced his price, he couldn't afford to pay his workers. So what happened? In a remarkably short space of time, within a year or two, the business went from being a big flourishing factory to nothing. It simply evaporated. Now, Clifford and Hilda had all their money tied up in the business, including they'd borrowed money against their house. So they were rendered virtually homeless with only a few thousands to spare. And they went to live in a mobile home, and Upton had a mobile home park, and they bought number 29 Upton Park, a small caravan, as it were, and that's where they lived. Now, they were churchgoers, not very devout, but they were churchgoers, and they continued to come to church, but Clifford became very, very depressed, as you can imagine. And he spent all his time at home, closeted away, apart from coming to church, and deeply unhappy. And Hilda likewise, although not quite to the same extent. But then he began to read his Bible. And he also began to read Christian books of various kinds. And gradually a real faith began to grow within him. And he began to go out and he would give people, do favours for people, taking them to hospital or whatever it might be. He became much more outgoing. And the key part, and I knew him well, so I was sort of in touch with him through all this process. And then, astonishingly, came the crux. He was able to say thank you to God for causing his business to fold and pushing him into poverty, because that enabled him to devote himself to Christ. That was the turning point, to say thank you for God for the catastrophe. Now, he became a real, alive Christian, as did Hilda. Now, they had no children, and strange to say, they both of them died a couple of years after what I've just been describing. And you might think, what a terrible sadness that was. But actually, I conducted both the funerals, and in a strange way, they were good funerals, because it felt as though their lives had been accomplished. They had received the saving grace of God, and that's what matters. So they were good deaths, as it were. Now, the third story, and the point I ought to draw the moral of that story, the Clifford and Hilda story, is they did find happiness in those last 2 years of their lives, but that was a byproduct. It wasn't what they were seeking. They came to be seeking God. As a byproduct of that, they did find, for a short time, happiness. Now, the third story is of a church in Harlow, and like a lot of evangelical churches, it started centred around a particular individual, a chap called Dave, if I remember correctly. And Dave was young, good-looking, a great speaker, full of vibrancy, very attractive, charismatic with a small C, and with a big C. It was a charismatic church. And he attracted lots of people. I don't think they ever had a building. They had some hall where they met. Attracted lots of people. Because he was so handsome, there tended to be women of a certain age who came. But nothing's wrong with that. That's the way life is. God works in lots of ways. And there it was, this flourishing, happy church. But then Dave began to, he was a bachelor, began to take advantage of some of the ladies in the church. And assuring them it was all God's will and he was a pastor, he knew about God and so on. Now, I won't go into the details, but as you can imagine, when this emerged, what was going on, the church simply imploded. The pastor was clearly a rascal, rogue, immoral, and things couldn't go on. And it simply collapsed. And it left a lot of people, not only the direct victims, but many others, with a deep sense of trauma. How could that have happened? They had put their faith in God, as it were, through this person, and he had betrayed them. It felt to them as if God had betrayed them. Now, it so happened, and I was at the beginning at the time, that two of the women in that church happened to come and visit. They were wanting a day out, a place of peace, and over a cup of tea, I got chatting to them. And that's how I know the story. There was nothing I could say particularly that would be helpful. I did my best, but we prayed together and so on. The one thing I did say to them, though, is perhaps God has brought you, the congregation, together, and you maybe consider trying to stay together as a church, even without Dave. And that was not an idea that they had immediately thought of. They had begun to sort of dribble away and go elsewhere. And these two women thought that might be a good idea. Now, that's the last I saw them. But I had a friend living in Harlow, still there, actually, and he kind of half knew this group, and he knew the story. And he told me, about a year later, that they were a number of them were still together as a group. They met once a week, not clear whether it was a Sunday or not, and they organised their services a bit like a sort of Alcoholics Anonymous group, or maybe an old-fashioned Methodist class meeting, that they sat in a circle, they prayed, they sang, they read the Bible, they shared their experiences. They didn't have a big pastor like Dave. It was very much an every-member ministry. They were ministering one to another. And according to my friends, they weren't particularly happy in any overt sense. The sort of exuberance of the past had gone, but seemingly, and I think this must be true, they were finding peace. Peace. Not happiness, but peace. Now, the conclusion I draw from all those stories is that happiness is not the thing that we preach. We don't guarantee happiness, but we guarantee something else. What is it? Now, let me tell you one. I know I'm full of stories today. It's New Year. Let me tell you one last story. I have to preface this by saying that I am a great lover of the Fens. I know not many people are. I love the Fens. I think there's some beautiful places, Upwell, Outwell, favourite places. And I like Fen people. And Sarah used to work in the Fens from Whittlesea. And she's a Fenophile like me. Now, if you think of Fen people, if you've known Fen people, perhaps you are a Fen person yourself. Happiness is not a quality you associate with Fen people. Doer, I think, would be the word. So they don't naturally become exuberant or jolly. They're the opposite of that. Now, that's by way of preface. Some years ago, I had a friend, now sadly died, who was a local preacher in a Methodist circuit that covered a large chunk of the Cambridgeshire Fens. And one Sunday, he telephoned me, and he said he was very ill, but he was due to preach that evening in Benwick, which is a Fen village. Could I stand in for him? All been squared with the minister and so on. So I said yes, I was free. And it was winter, if I remember, so I sort of drove through the gathering Fen gloom to Benwick. Now, the Methodist church in Benwick, now sadly demolished because it became too dangerous, had a list as fen buildings often do, because it was subsided more that side than that side. And so when you, that's why it's been demolished, it just got too dangerous. When you got into the church, it meant all the pews were like that, which meant you couldn't actually sit in the middle of a pew because your bottom would inexorably slide towards that side. So how they organised themselves is they all sat at the pew ends, as it were. So there would be, sort of imagine John as a big fen farmer, and Dot is his formidable lady. They were sort of sitting there. So coming into the church to preach, there was all these couples sort of slotted at the end of pews. And they sort of glared up at me. And so I was very apprehensive. And we had hymns and Bible reading and so on. And then the turn came for me to preach. And I thought I couldn't be anything else but me. There was no point in trying to sort of imagine how they felt. I just had to be me. And so, as you know, I make sort of rather mildly amusing remarks from time to time. So I just preach like that. And clearly I realised I was completely bamboozling them. They didn't know what I was about. And the glare became more and more... but eventually, about 10 minutes in, quite a long sermon, they got it. They suddenly realised I was actually being quite light-hearted, and they kind of got the joke, as it were. And they began smiling, and even laughing occasionally. I didn't want to exaggerate this. And it became, actually, a very good occasion. And afterwards, as we sort of filtered out, these great big sort of fen farming hands shook me by the hand. You know, really pleased. Thank you, Mr. Vanderbilt, whatever they called me. Now, what I got from that service, and this is the point I'm getting to, is these fen people, as I say, you wouldn't apply the word happy to them, but what they had was joy. That's what I felt from that congregation. There was real joy, if not happiness. Now, what's the difference between happiness and joy? We would often, people around would use them synonymously, but actually they're entirely different. Happiness is something that comes and goes. All of us in our lives have happy times and sad times, bereavement, illness, or whatever it might be. Happiness is not the deal. It comes and it goes. Part of the deal is coping with that. What we do have, through the resurrection of Christ, is joy. Happiness belongs to the earth. Joy belongs in heaven. And it comes through our relationship with Christ in heaven. We are already participating in, as it were, the feast, the conversation of heaven. And the sign of that participation is joy. And joy, that joy, doesn't come and go. It's eternal, because Christ is eternal. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the gift of joy. We thank you that we can have a personal relationship with your Son, Jesus Christ. That we can share with him the joy of your heavenly kingdom, even as we live on earth. We thank you that our Lord Jesus Christ comes to us, through his Spirit guides us, counsels us, encourages us. Is it, please? There's a debate going on in the Times as to the origin of the phrase, it'll cost you an arm and a leg. And there's a nice Jewish joke that gives the origin of this phrase. There's Adam, and God comes to Adam and says, what you need is a wife, and I'll make you one. She'll be fantastic. She'll be beautiful. She'll make wonderful meals for you. She'll be kind and considerate even when you've got man flu. She'll even be good at parking. All the things you could possibly want in a woman. But it'll cost you. It'll cost you an arm and a leg. And Adam thinks for a moment, what can I get for a rib? I think that's a fabulous joke. Anyway, there, May.